going to look briefly at a Bible story. Quite an interesting one. Very interesting one, in fact. About a man called Zacchaeus. And he's an interesting character. An interesting man. And he lived in a city called Jericho. And he met Jesus in a rather peculiar way. And this is the story. Luke chapter 19. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. Incidentally, there were no poor tax collectors. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. And when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So Zacchaeus came down at once and welcomed Jesus gladly. And all the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man," that means Jesus himself, by the way, "came to seek and to save what was lost." You could rewrite, "For I came to seek and save what was lost." That's Jesus' opinion of his ministry. "I came," he said, "to seek and to save what was lost." Let's begin with a story. My cousin is married to a now retired engineer who was for many, many years one of the chief engineers, one of the big engineering companies in the UK. At the time he was, this is going back many decades now, he was building, he was in charge of a big building works, big shopping centre in Cardiff. And he's Irish. So you won't be surprised to know that nearly all his labour force was Irish as well. And one day one of his workforce came up to him, because everyone trusted him. He's a very honest guy, Seamus. Said, "Seamus, can you help me with this?" And Seamus said, "Well, I'll try. What is this?" And the guy produced a ring, silver, with a stone, apparently a diamond. The guy said, "Well, I've got this, and I'm not sure what to do about it." Because obviously, he said, you know, the stone is costume jewellery, but it looks like it's a proper silver kind of ring. He said, "What happens, I went to a car boot sale, and one of the stalls was a box full of costume jewellery." He said, my daughters love dressing up, and it was, for 50p, you could just buy this box of costume jewellery. I thought, well, they'll have so much fun dressing up with it. So he bought this box of costume jewellery all thrown in there. Took it home and looked at it. Then he said, "I looked at this and it looked to me that it was, if it was not costume jewellery, it looks like a proper silver ring with some kind of stone on it." So he said, "I took it to a jeweller's shop in Swansea and he offered me £100 for it." And I thought, wait a minute, there's something happening here. Seems an awful lot of money for this. She said, I suspect he just might be trying to diddle me now. I don't know what's happening. What is this genuine? Is it, what is this? So Seamus said, "Well, actually, we've got a jeweller here in the centre of Cardiff who is as honest as the day is long. This guy, I can absolutely vouch for this guy. Let's take it round to him." But before that, my cousin's husband, he got a magnifying glass out. He looked on the back and he found a hallmark on the back. Well, this looks quite interesting. So they went round to the jeweller. And the jeweller looked at the ring and they said, "Well, look, you know, we think it's costume jewellery, but that could be silver." And so the jeweller got his stuff out and looked at it. He said, well, firstly, it's not silver. That's white gold. Now let's take a look at the stone. And he looked at the stone. He said, that is probably the biggest, best cut diamond you will ever see in your life. Let's take a look at the hallmark. And he looked at the hallmark and he laughed. He said, that is, and I forget the name, Seamus did tell me, I've forgotten the name. That is one of the most famous jewelers in the world. In fact, this guy designed for Fabergé. So Seamus said, how much is it worth? And the guy hummed and hawed, said, well, and it's going back, what, 30 years? He hummed and hawed, it's probably worth about £35,000. Let's get it properly valued. And they got it properly valued, and they sold it for £34,000. And the guy went around and gave £1,000 to the jeweller for his help in so on. So everyone was happy. The point is, you can have something in your hand that's of immense worth and you don't realise how much it's worth, can't you? It's so easy to overlook the worth of something. You don't realise that is the most precious thing. I don't realise it. And the same thing can happen in your spiritual life. You can have something that is of so much worth to you spiritually, but you just don't realise it's precious. And what I'm trying to explain this evening is that to many people, Jesus is like that ring. It was in that guy's hand and he didn't know how much it's worth. For many people, they've heard of Jesus. They know about Jesus. They just don't realise how precious Jesus is and what a difference he can make to your life and how he can change your life and put you on two feet. How Jesus can be your saviour and your friend. They don't realise it's just a name in a book or something Christians subscribe to. It's not. Well, look, when I talk to you about Jesus, please understand I'm talking to you about the most precious thing in the history of the world. The most precious thing to you for your spiritual life cannot possibly be greater than Jesus is. So I just want to encourage you this evening to think about Jesus for yourself. Why not follow Jesus? Why not become a Jesus follower yourself? The story of Zacchaeus is beloved by Sunday school children. If you've been brought up in a Sunday school, you will at some point have been taught about Zacchaeus. And children love it, Sunday school teachers love it. He was a short guy, so you enjoy that. He couldn't see over everyone's head, so children think that's funny. And he climbs a tree, which is a funny sort of thing to do. And children love that. And of course, it gives them a chance to cut out a tree and make a little palm tree. And then cut out a little Zacchaeus and stick him in the tree. And children love doing that. And, well, why not? It's great fun. The trouble with that is that you never come back to look at the story as an adult. Because as though it's kind of got a humorous side to it, I suppose, to some extent, with the guy climbing the tree, and Jesus stopping right under the tree to his amazement, and saying, I'm coming to tea in your house, mate. Yeah? Whoa! That was not expected. It's got little twists and turns. But there's a very serious point here, because truth is, Zacchaeus was a very lost man. He was a complicated man. He had various sides to his character. To us, he's a figure of fun, best because we learnt as a child. We drew him, we coloured him in as children and stuck him in a tree. So to us, he's a figure of fun. But in the Bible, he's not really presented as a figure of fun at all. And to those who understood what's going on with him, there's a dark side to him. Today, tax inspectors are very respectable people who own Labradors, drive Volvos, and read the Daily Telegraph. In Jesus' day, tax collectors were very dodgy characters. They were very ambivalent kind of people. You had to have them, you had to get on with them. But the truth was, you looked at them with certain suspicion, and nobody really liked them, although everybody kept on their side. Bishop Tom Wright, commenting on this passage, wrote this lovely little passage. He said, "Wherever money changes hands, whether across a grubby table in a tin shack or across a sparkling computer screen in a shiny office in the 99th floor of Wall Street, the hand all too easily gets dirty. Whenever money starts to talk, it shouts louder than the claims of honour, respect and human dignity." Zacchaeus was not employed. Zacchaeus was a tax collector because he bought the franchise. That's how it worked. These days, you might buy the franchise of Costa Coffee. You might buy the... I'm not good on franchises. You might buy the franchise of Burger King and set up the Burger King at the corner of your road. In Jesus' day, you bought the franchise as a tax collector. You bought the right to collect taxes. And obviously, if you've bought the right to collect taxes, you expected to make the money back from siphoning off a proportion for yourself. And because the tax laws were so vague, you could almost set the taxes that you wanted. Now, you had to be careful. If you over-egged it, if you collected too many taxes, you annoyed the Romans and you annoyed everybody else. So you had to be sensible. You had to be subtle. But you kind of set the taxes. You handed over to the Romans what they wanted and kept what was over for yourself. So, you know, I mean, this couldn't possibly happen, but somebody might come up to you and say, "How much VAT do I pay on my Cornish pasty?" And you might say, "Well, it depends if it's hot or if it's cold." That wouldn't happen in real life, of course. But basically, you'd go to Zacchaeus, you'd say, "How much tax do I pay on this?" And Zacchaeus would think, "Well, how much can I get away with?" And you'd try and argue him down. So basically, you didn't want to fall out with him. And he didn't want to fall out with you. It's a very political game, this. So you would culture a certain friendship with Zacchaeus in order that he didn't charge you too much in the way of tax. And he would culture a friendship with you so that you wouldn't complain too much about how much he was levying from you. He's a very political man. I can just imagine his household full of people calling in every day, just trying to sort out the taxes with him, come cut some kind of deal with the tax collector. I imagine his house was very busy. I imagine that he was a very shrewd man, and he was very knowledgeable. He knew the price of everything, and how much tax he could charge on it. I imagine his house full of fun, because so many people would visit his house, he would have to have quite a large staff, and his family, and the extended family, and so there'd be the cousin, son and daughter who were studying in Jerusalem, so they'd be there, or in Jericho, no, they'd be there. He would have had a huge household, and there'd be constant food and drink on the go. But at what point did Zacchaeus realize that he was lost? Well, we don't know. At what point did his conscience catch up with him? At what point did he begin to realize he had been unfair to some people? At what point did he begin to lose sleep? And at what point did he begin to say, "Well, there's something missing in my life. I've got wealth, I've got position, I've got a busy life, I've got a family, but there's something missing. There's just something missing." I was very moved to read an extract from the journal of a rock singer. This is before some of your time. The guy was called Kurt Cobain, and a very troubled man who ended up taking his own life. He wrote this about himself: "I'm an alcoholic, self-destructive, yet overtly sensitive, frail, fragile, soft-spoken, narcoleptic, neurotic, who at any moment is going to OD, jump off a roof, wig out, blow my head off, or all three at once. Oh, please, God, I can't handle the success." At what point did Zacchaeus realise something was missing in his life? I lived for many years in Brazil with my family, and I was invited to preach at a little place called Terra Nova, New Land it's called, a little clearing in the forest where poor families were starting a life themselves. They had a plot of land and a little shack in the town, a little wooden shack, and they were doing all right. And there was a little church formed there, and they invited me to go and spend a few days preaching with them, so I did. And the first night, I met a man called Louise. And Louise had a wife and a daughter, and he was doing all right. And we talked, and that was it. And that was on the Thursday, past the Friday, Saturday. On a Sunday evening, he turned up in church again. I was preaching on Zacchaeus. And what I didn't know was in the interval, he'd not been able to sleep. And he was laying in bed for those nights, troubled by a question that was buzzing around his brain. He couldn't get out of his thoughts. So the question was, what's missing in your life? What's missing in your life? Had land, wife, daughter, health. I don't know. What's missing? Something missing. I don't know what it is. And he came to church on a Sunday evening because maybe he'd find something that was missing there. And I stood up and my opening words, I remember them now, my opening words were, what's missing in your life? Well, I didn't understand why this guy was sitting on the edge of his seat with his eyes out on stalks. I had no idea what I'd said. But he sat perched. You know, somebody sat on the edge of their seat, just, you know. I didn't know what had been going on at all. So at close of service, I said, look, I don't know what's missing in your life, but it could be Jesus. Why don't, if you want Jesus in life, why don't you come to the front and we'll pray together? Well, you talk about the Olympics and these guys starting out, getting out of the blocks quickly. This guy's a beat all record coming to the front, and he just said, I want Jesus, you know. This is it, this is it, this is what I want, this is what I was missing. It was Jesus. And Zacchaeus had the same kind of experience. He came to Jesus, and he climbed the tree so he could see him, and he found Jesus. I've been reading recently this book. It's a smashing book. It's called Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril, by Margaret Heffernan. And the book begins, it's a great book. It's about how we ignore something that's in front of our eyes and we choose to ignore it. She says, on July the 19th, 2011, MP Adrian Saunders asked James and Rupert Murdoch a question that temporarily silenced them both. He said, are you familiar with the term willful blindness? And they were lost for words. Willful blindness is a legal term, and it means when we refuse to examine something that we should, that we're actually responsible for. Let me give you an example. You go on your gap year to Thailand, let's say, and meet this very charming person. He says, I tell you what, for £15,000, would you like to take this suitcase back to North Wales with you? And you say, for £15,000, I'll take this suitcase anywhere for you. And so you take the suitcase and you board the plane. And the police swoop. And they open that suitcase and it's full of cocaine. And in your defense, you stand up and you say to the court, well, I didn't know what was in the suitcase. I didn't look. Do you think that will be an adequate defence? It won't be, because in the law there's such a thing as willful blindness. And what the court will say to you is, you could have looked, but you chose not to. That is no defence. That is willful blindness. You chose not to look. Zacchaeus could have chosen not to look for Jesus. Could have chosen that. But he would have been responsible for what happened for the rest of his life. You and I can choose not to look into Jesus, not to consider Jesus. That, on our own heads, is that decision. That's willful blindness. What I say to you is, why don't you take a leaf out of Zacchaeus' book? Look into Jesus. Why don't you go home? Get yourself a New Testament and read one of the stories of Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke or John. Anyone will do. Take a look at it and think for yourself. Maybe Jesus is what I'm looking for. Maybe Jesus is that precious diamond ring that's in my hand and I hadn't realized. Maybe I'm lost and need to be found. Maybe Jesus is the one who needs to put me on the right road. You can expect opposition if you follow that road. People won't necessarily understand. Your friends at school will take the mickey. Your parents will get concerned, perhaps. But if you're following Jesus, you're following the master, you're following the one who died on the cross and rose again. You can't go wrong if you're following Jesus. One of my favourite songs is by a Welsh singer called Gwyneth Glyn. It's called Adra. It's a song about belonging and longing for something in your soul, in your heart. It's not specifically about God or about Jesus at all, although she does have a degree in theology from Oxford University, so I sometimes wonder if there isn't something in there. But whenever I read it, and I'm not the only one, a number of people have said this to me, they just seem to find Jesus in this song. And there's a part near the end of the song where she sings this. I'll say it in Welsh and I'll translate. Dwi'n cae fy nghlygaid ac agor fy nenaid a dilyn lôn dy lais. I close my eyes, I open my soul, and I follow down the lane of your voice. I follow your voice down the lane. And that to me just describes totally what it is to become a follower of Jesus. I close my eyes, I open my soul, and I follow his voice down into the water of baptism, out and into the rest of my life. So let me encourage you, please, to go home, to read one of the Gospels about Jesus, and to think maybe Jesus is the lost treasure in your life that you need to receive. And perhaps you too need to follow Jesus and make a decision. Our young people will be taking a service in a few weeks' time, and I'm sure they're going to invite you to that. But you're always welcome to come and talk to me if you're interested in knowing more about following Jesus.